greatcoat and a misshapen top hat he wore pulled low over his eyes, he looked more like a tradesman or shopkeeper down on his luck than the kind of man who lent money to kings and emperors. He stood with his hands in his pockets, his expression, as always, utterly unreadable. When Sebastian paused before him, Rothschild simply blinked and turned his head to stare at the arched arcade on the far side of the snow-choked courtyard.
"Go away. You're bad for business."
Sebastian cast a significant glance around the largely deserted quadrangle. "The exchange isn't exactly booming at the moment."
"All the more reason for you to go away."
Sebastian tipped his head to one side. "Now, why wouldn't you want to talk to me, I wonder?" Rothschild fixed Sebastian with a deadened glare. An extraordinarily ugly man, with a big round head, protruding cleft chin and large pouty lips, he looked to be somewhere in his late 40s or 50s, his red hair already fading to grey. But he was actually still in his 30s, just 5 years older than Sebastian himself.
"You think I don't know why you're here?"
"Actually, I assumed you did." The Rothschild family, which included four other brothers strategically placed in Paris, Vienna, Frankfurt, and Naples, was said to maintain a magnificent network of spies, informants, and courtiers that rivaled or perhaps even exceeded those of powerful statesmen such as Jarvis and Metternich. The financier's eyes narrowed with what looked like a cross between annoyance and animosity.
"Jane Ambrose ceased to function as my daughter's piano instructor weeks ago."
"So I'd heard. Why, I wonder?"
"Do you indeed? And yet I fail to see why I should answer any of your decidedly impertinent questions."
Sebastian let his lips pull back into a smile.
"I suppose the answer to that depends on how much you have to hide."
A sound that might have been a laugh shook the other man's fleshy frame.
"Are you threatening me? Seriously? Me?"
"You find that statement threatening?"
"Have you by chance spoken with your father-in-law?"
"No, should I have?"
"I'd no notion Jarvis was involved in the selection and dismissal of your children's music instructors."
Rothschild shrugged.
"Jane Ambrose was no doubt an excellent pianist. Unfortunately, my daughter Anna has exhibited little interest in music and even less talent. Hence the decision to terminate our arrangement."
"Really? That's odd."
"Odd? What? Why?"
"Because I'm told Jane Ambrose considered your daughter an unusually promising student."
"I can only assume that if Mrs. Ambrose did indeed say such a thing, then she was simply being kind. Despite a father's inevitable prejudices, even I must admit my little Anna was a vast waste of Mrs. Ambrose's time."
"And your money,
obviously."
"What I find particularly curious is that Jane Ambrose wasn't simply upset by her dismissal. She was frightened." Rothschild pursed his full lips.
"She told someone that? Who?"
"Not in so many words. I gather it was more along the lines of an observation."
Curious. I know of no reason why the woman should have been frightened, but I assure you it had nothing to do with me."
"When was her last lesson with your daughter?" Rothschild shrugged.
"Surely you don't expect me to recall precisely. It was near the end of the great fog. The lessons were always on a Tuesday."
"And when did you terminate your arrangement with her?"
"That afternoon."
"You spoke to Jane Ambrose yourself?"
"As it happens, I did, yes."
"And she didn't seem upset at the time?"
"She expressed disappointment, but she acknowledged that given Anna's lack of talent, there was little sense in continuing."
"I see. And your daughter is how old?" Rothschild hesitated a moment, as if a response required some calculation.
10.
"Would you mind if I spoke to her?"
"I'm afraid that's impossible. The poor child is naturally grieved by the death of someone she both knew and respected. I wouldn't want to do anything that might upset her further."
"Of course," said Sebastian, settling his top hat lower on his forehead. Thank you for your assistance.
Rothschild simply inclined his head and dug his hands deeper into his pockets. Sebastian started to turn away, then paused to glance back and say,
You wouldn't by chance know what might have taken Jane Ambrose to Clerkenwell yesterday, would you?
Hardly. I was scarcely acquainted with the woman.
Yes. So you said.
Sebastian was aware of the rich man's gaze following him as he crossed the quadrangle toward the main entrance with its ornate looming clock tower. And it came to him, as he pushed his way through the small knot of shivering Barbadian, Jamaican, and Spanish traders congregated around a brazier there, that for someone who claimed he had no explicable reason to be interested in Jane Ambrose, Nathan Rothschild was nevertheless curiously well informed about the true nature of her death. Because Sebastian would never have been here asking questions if Jane hadn't been murdered. And Rothschild obviously not only understood that, but he hadn't been surprised by it. Not only that, but for reasons Sebastian couldn't explain but certainly intended to discover, Rothschild had likewise taken it for granted that her death involved the regent's powerful cousin and Sebastian's own father-in-law, Charles, Lord Jarvis. Chapter 8. Her Royal Highness, Princess Charlotte Augusta of Wales, granddaughter of King George III, only legitimate issue of the Prince of Wales and heiress presumptive to the throne of the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Ireland, lived with her attendants in a cramped and decrepit 17th-century brick structure known as Warwick House. Lying on the far side of a narrow lane to the southeast of the Prince's own palace of Carlton House, Warwick House had served as Princess Charlotte's home ever since her father, in the grip of one of the endless remodelling schemes for his grandiose palace, had cast covetous eyes on his daughter's apartments and decided to move her out. She'd been 8 at the time. Charlotte had lived alone ever since, with no one in the house who wasn't paid to be there with her. Her mother had been banished years before and was seldom allowed to see her. Her father, the prince, visited even less. Her care was entrusted to the oversight of a succession of aging noblewomen who held the honorary title of governess to the princess. The current holder of that position was the middle-aged Dowager Duchess of Leeds, an ostentatious grande dame with annoying airs of condescension and a long-winded, boring fixation on her own health, who typically put in an appearance at Warwick House between the hours of 2 and 5. Assisting the Duchess were 2 live-in ladies, also gently born, but considerably more impoverished. Although officially styled as sub-governesses, they essentially functioned as minders. The Princess's actual education was managed by the Bishop of Salisbury, a humourless, pretentious prelate who oversaw an array of specialised tutors and instructors. The previous year, as her 17th birthday approached, Charlotte had dreamed of throwing off her fusty old governess, replacing the sub-governesses with true companions styled as ladies-in-waiting, and finally being free to attend balls, dinners, and the theatre like any other young lady her age. That ambition was ruthlessly squashed by her father, the regent. Charlotte then looked at her ageing, unmarried aunts, the daughters of George III, who were living out their wasted lives shut up at Windsor Castle, in what Charlotte had long ago nicknamed the nunnery, and panicked. Hero arrived at Warwick House midday through the morning, unable to use her carriage in the snow-filled streets and scorning sedan chairs. She pulled on demi-brocans of fine morocco lined with fur, wrapped herself in a fur-trimmed pelisse with a matching Swedish hat fastened up on one side, and walked. It was a shockingly outré thing to call on a royal princess on foot and stomp snow all over the cracked tiles of her dilapidated entrance hall. But then, Hero hadn't come to visit Princess Charlotte. Hero was here to see her friend, Miss Ella Kinsworth. A tall, angular woman with greying dark hair, Miss Kinsworth had in years past enjoyed the kind of adventurous, independent life a younger hero had once envisioned for herself. The unmarried daughter of an admiral, Miss Kinsworth had lived abroad for decades with her widowed mother and supported herself by writing books. But the wars eventually made continued residence on the continent dangerous, and the death of her mother had diminished her income. Now, in her late 50s, alone and impoverished, Miss Kinsworth was reduced to serving a royal family not known for endearing itself to retainers. For 7 years she had held the position of companion to George III's foul-tempered queen, before being appointed to serve as one of Princess Charlotte's sub-governesses. In a spirited, daring rebellion, Miss Kinsworth had honoured the young princess's wishes by insisting on being called a lady companion, rather than a sub-governess. It was a tribute to both the force of her personality and the respect in which she was held that she'd been allowed to get away with it. "This ferocious weather," said Miss Kinsworth, as she whisked Hero up to her small private sitting room on Warwick House's first floor, not far from the princess's bedchamber. "You should have let me come to you, my lady." "Nonsense," said Hero, ridding herself of ice-encrusted mittens, hat, scarf, and pelisse. "The walk was..." She paused, searching for the right word as she sank into a chair beside the sitting room's fire, and finally settled on "bracing." Miss Kinsworth took the seat opposite, the smile in her grey eyes fading. "Don't tell me you're here because Jane Ambrose was murdered?" Hero looked up from holding her cold hands out to the blaze. "What makes you think it was murder?"
"I didn't think it before, but I'm not vain enough to believe you tromped through the snow on a day such as this simply to pay me a social visit. Was Jane murdered?"
"I'm afraid she probably was, yes." Miss Kinsworth's face quivered, and she looked away. "Ah, poor Jane." Hero studied the older woman's tightly held profile. "How well did you know her?"
"I've known Jane for years. She used to teach piano to Princess Amelia when I was with the Queen, and she's been Charlotte's instructor since the girl was quite small."
Miss Kinsworth drew in a deep, shaky breath.
"Needless to say, Charlotte is devastated. Jane was with her longer than almost anyone, except perhaps her personal maid, Mrs. Lewis. The prince is constantly dismissing the princess's servants, you know, as well as her governesses, sub-governesses, and tutors."
"Why?"
Miss Kinsworth turned her head to meet Hero's gaze.
"Do you want to know the truth?"
"Yes."
"It's because he wants them to be loyal to him and him alone, and to unhesitatingly enforce his most arbitrary and heartless decrees. But Charlotte is a sweet, generous, likable soul who quickly wins the hearts and allegiance of those who are around her for long. When that happens, the prince dismisses them."
"Beastly man," said Hero.
"You can say that, my lady. Unfortunately, I cannot. At least not aloud."
Hero gave a soft laugh.
"So was Jane Ambrose here for the princess's lesson yesterday?"
"She was, yes. She left as usual shortly after 12 o'clock, just as the snow was beginning to fall. I remember because I happened to look out the window and saw her crossing the courtyard toward the gate."
"Do you know how she planned to spend the rest of the day?"
"Sorry, no. I assumed she was going home, but I don't know for certain. I saw her when she first came in and said good morning, but that was about all."
"Did she seem nervous or frightened in any way?"
"Frightened? I don't think so.
No.
Although I did sense a certain..."
Miss Kinsworth hesitated.
"I don't quite know how to put it. We've all been under a bit of strain lately, and she did seem preoccupied by something. Trying to put a cheerful face on it, but I had the feeling her thoughts were elsewhere."
"You've no idea what might have been troubling her?"
"No, sorry."
Given that Jane had been raped a day or two before her death, Hero suspected her preoccupation might well have been tied to that. But it was awkward to discuss such things in polite company. To even address the subject was a delicate exercise to be wrapped up in all sorts of polite euphemisms such as "interfered with" or "an act too infamous to be named."
Hero said bluntly, "She never mentioned anything about someone forcing himself on her."
Miss Kinsworth's face went slack.
"Good heavens, no. You think that's what happened to her? Is that why she was killed?"
"It's possible.
Or it could be completely unrelated." "Oh, poor Jane." The older woman's lips parted. "She never said anything to me."
Hero wasn't surprised. Women who were raped usually didn't talk about it if they could help it. For most, their rape was a dark, shameful secret to be hidden and dealt with in private, if at all. It was also possible that Edward Ambrose had violently forced himself on his own wife. In that case, under British law, such an act would not have been considered rape or illegal in any way.
Hero cleared her throat. "Jane had children." "She did, yes. Two boys, but both died last year. She lost the younger child first, to the flux, and the other, Lawrence, just last autumn, to consumption."
"How unbearably tragic," said Hero.
"It was, yes. Music and those children were Jane's world. When she lost the boys, it was as if a light went out of her life."
"Was she happy in her marriage, do you think?"
Miss Kinsworth smoothed a hand over the skirt of her sensible worsted gown.
"To be honest, I wouldn't say she was, no. But it's sometimes hard to tell, isn't it? We never discussed it."
"What makes you think she might not have been?"
"It wasn't anything she said, precisely. But I sometimes suspected she had a certain measure of resentment toward her husband."
"Resentment? Do you know why?"
"No. Although sometimes I wondered..."
The other woman paused.
"Yes,"
said Hero.
Miss Kinsworth looked troubled. "I've sometimes wondered if she didn't in some way resent Edward Ambrose's success as a composer. I hesitated to say it because that makes her sound like a petty, jealous person, and she wasn't that way at all. She was good and kind and giving. A truly warm, caring person. And yet, you know what it's like for women. She was forced to give up performing, even though she was every bit as talented and accomplished a pianist as her twin brother. She was also an amazing composer, who could have produced pieces much grander than the glees and ballads and simple chamber music she was known for."
"So why didn't she?"
"I asked her that once. She said it's one thing to write an opera or symphony. Something else entirely to find an orchestra willing to perform a piece composed by a woman."
"Ah, yes, I can see that."
"When her brother James was alive, he actually published some of her pieces as his own. She said he hated that she didn't get credit for them, but he thought they deserved to be performed, and he knew that was the only way it would happen. I've heard Mozart did the same for his sister, Maria Anna." "I suspect it's far more common than anyone would like to admit," said Miss Kinsworth.
Hero nodded, and the two women sat in companionable silence, quietly sharing a lifelong cold anger at the limitations society placed on their sex. After a moment, Hero said, "Do you have any idea who might have wanted to see her dead?"
"Who might have killed her, you mean?"
The older woman pressed the fingers of one hand to her lips.
"There is someone, isn't there?"
said Hero, watching her. Miss Kinsworth thrust up from her chair and went to stand at a narrow-sashed window, looking out over the snow-covered city, her arms crossed and her elbows held close to her chest. After a moment she said, "This is very delicate, given the circumstances, but there is a gentleman attached to the Dutch embassy. Van der Pals is his name. Peter Van der Pals."
"Yes, I met him recently when I was visiting my father," said Hero. "I understand he's become quite popular with London's hostesses in a surprisingly short time."
"He has, yes. He's an extraordinarily handsome, charming man. At one point he was quite friendly with Jane."
"Meaning?"
"Oh, nothing serious. Please don't misunderstand me. But he did single her out, and I think she was flattered by his teasing attentions. What woman would not be?
He is very attractive.
So what happened? Prompted Hero.
It turned out he was simply trying to cajole her into spying for him.
Good heavens.
On Princess Charlotte, you mean?
Yes.
Hero had no need to ask why a member of the Dutch ambassador's entourage would be interested in spying on Princess Charlotte. It was an open secret that the Prince Regent was eager to see his daughter married, and that the needle-thin, awkward and decidedly unattractive William, hereditary Prince of Orange, nicknamed Slender Billy, was his favoured suitor. For his part, Orange was said to be more than eager to wed the woman who would some day reign as Queen of England.
When was this?
That Jane realised what he wanted?
One day last week.
Last Thursday, I believe. Needless to say, she refused. He then tried to bribe her, and when that failed,
he turned ugly, quite ugly.
How do you know this? Said Hero.
Because Jane came to me the next day and told me. She thought I needed to know in case he should approach other members of the princess's household. It seems that when she refused, he threatened her.
Threatened her? How?
He warned her not to tell anyone, and said she'd be sorry if she did.
Miss Kinsworth turned to face Hero, her arms still hugged close to her chest.
She was quite shaken. Did you tell anyone else about Van der Pals?
No.
Not even the Duchess of Leeds?
Miss Kinsworth grimaced.
Technically, I suppose I should have, but I thought it best to keep it to myself.
Could Jane herself have told someone?
Perhaps, although I warned her not to.
It was a statement that spoke volumes about the degree of mistrust, suspicion, and backstabbing in the princess's household.
Hero said, "Would it be possible for me to ask Princess Charlotte about her last lesson with Jane?"
Miss Kinsworth made a scoffing sound deep in her throat.
"Not if Lady Leeds has anything to say about it."
She looked thoughtful a moment, then said, "Charlotte and I frequently go for walks in the afternoon. If I sent you word, perhaps you could contrive to come upon us. Quite by accident, of course."
Hero smiled.
"Yes, I believe I could manage that."
Chapter 9 The Dutch courtier, Peter van der Pals, had arrived in London the previous December in the train of his good friend William, the hereditary Prince of Orange. A strikingly handsome man, with a strong jawline, softly curling auburn hair, and a wide boyish smile, the courtier was, like Orange, quite young. His English was extraordinarily good, for he had attended Oxford with his prince, and also, like Orange, served as aide-de-camp to Arthur Wellesley. Yet he had chosen to remain in London when Orange had returned to the newly liberated Netherlands. At the time, Hero had wondered why. Now she thought she understood. On leaving Warwick House, she turned her steps toward the residence of the Dutch ambassador, intending to make inquiries there into the young courtier. But as she neared the ambassador's stately townhouse, she was fortunate enough to find van der Pals himself carefully descending the embassy's icy front steps. At the sight of Hero, he drew up, a faint expression of puzzlement crossing his handsome features before being hidden away behind a courtier's practiced smile. "Lady Devlin," he said, his elegant bows somewhat spoiled by his refusal to let go of the railing beside him. "You are beyond courageous venturing out in this weather. Unfortunately, His Excellency the Ambassador is not at present here."
"That's quite all right," said Hero, smiling. "As it happens, I was actually looking for you. Shall we go inside for a moment? I'd like to ask you some questions."
Van der Pals hesitated the briefest instant, but one did not rebuff the daughter of the most powerful man in the kingdom. He bowed again. "Of course." Nodding to the liveried footman at the door, he ushered her into a small, overheated withdrawing room just off the grand entrance hall. "Please, my lady, do take a seat. Shall I ring for tea?" His recitation of the requisite polite formalities was everything it should have been, except that the courtier made no attempt to remove his greatcoat and simply stood inside the door, his hat in his hands, in a none too subtle message.
"Neither will be necessary, thank you."
Hero eased open the throat latch of her fur-trimmed pelisse as the heat of the room enveloped her.
"I assume you know why I'm here."
A courtier gave a startled laugh.
"Actually, no. I fear you'll find me quite at a loss."
"Should I?"
"When a man threatens a woman who later turns up dead, he must surely expect to be the object of scrutiny."
Vanderpals shook his head in a credible show of confusion that Hero might have assumed was real if she hadn't known his type as well as she did.
"I don't understand," he said. "What dead woman?"
"Jane Ambrose."
"Ah."
He raised one hand to pinch the bridge of his nose as if overcome by distress.
"But Mrs. Ambrose's death was caused by a fall. It was in the papers this morning. The streets have become beyond treacherous with all this snow and ice."
"They have indeed."
"Yet Jane Ambrose did not slip on the ice and hit her head. It appears that she was, in all likelihood, murdered. Quite viciously."
"Murdered?" His expression of shock was everything it should have been, and potentially every bit as false as his earlier show of confusion.
"How perfectly ghastly. But I still don't understand what any of this has to do with me."
The heat from the room's fireplace was becoming overwhelming. Hero quietly tugged off her fur-lined mittens. "Perhaps I should explain that we know you tried to charm Jane Ambrose into spying on Princess Charlotte for the House of Orange. When charm failed, you attempted bribery. And when that too was unsuccessful, you warned her that if she told anyone of your overtures, you would make certain that she... how did you put it? Ah, yes. You said she'd be sorry."
"Who told you this?"
he hissed. He was no longer smiling.
"You don't seriously expect me to answer that, do you? Yet you expect me to respond to these absurd accusations?"
Hero raised one eyebrow.
"You deny the encounter took place?" "Of course I deny it."
"So you're suggesting what?
That Jane Ambrose made up the entire tale out of whole cloth? Either Mrs. Ambrose or whoever regaled you with this nonsense, yes."
"And precisely what would be the purpose of such a deception?"
"Presumably to discredit me, and by extension the House of Orange."
"Oh? And why would Jane Ambrose wish to discredit you or your prince?" The Dutchman's eyes narrowed.
"Forgive me, my lady, but why are you here asking these questions? As Lord Jarvis's envoy? Or for some other reason?"
It was an astute question, and one that forced Hero to be more honest than she would have liked. "I am here because Jane Ambrose's association with Princess Charlotte precludes a more formal investigation of her murder." She gave him an icy stare.
"Is there a reason you're avoiding answering my questions?"
Vanderpals went to stand facing the room's fireplace, one fist resting on the mantel, his gaze on the blaze on the hearth. After a moment he said,
"This is a trifle delicate, but the truth is that Mrs. Ambrose and I enjoyed a light flirtation. Nothing serious, you understand. But I fear she must have read more into my gallantry than was intended. For when she chanced one day to see me laughing quite innocently, I assure you, with Lady Arabella, she flew into a frightful rage. It was really quite shocking."
He glanced up at Hero in a way that caused a boyish shock of hair to fall over his forehead. He was an extraordinarily attractive young man, and he not only knew it, but was accustomed to using his looks to disarm and cajole. Hero was not easily disarmed.
"Who is Lady Arabella?"
"Lady Arabella Osborne, daughter of the princess's governess, the Duchess of Leeds. The Duchess recently introduced her to Warwick House in the hopes of providing the princess with a friend close to her own age. But the girl is still quite young, and rather unsure of herself, so I sought to try to put her at ease. I never imagined Jane would react so violently.
His use of the dead woman's given name was both suggestive and, Hero suspected, deliberate. She said,
"You would have me think that you and Jane Ambrose were lovers?"
His wonderful white teeth flashed as he gave an embarrassed laugh.
"Good heavens, no. Ours was a flirtation only, as I said, although Jane obviously thought things more serious than I had intended."
He tipped his head to one side as if struck by a sudden thought.
"Have you considered that she might have been killed as a result of a lover's quarrel?"
"You're saying Jane Ambrose had a lover? Who?"
"I've no idea. Yet you have no difficulty suggesting that she might have one."
He spread his arms wide as if in surrender.
"It wasn't my intention to offend you, my lady. Simply to give you a hint as to the nature of the woman we're discussing."
"You mean that she was the type of woman who might have been unfaithful to her husband?"
Rather than answer, he glanced significantly at the clock on the mantel and gave a faint, startled exclamation, as if suddenly becoming aware of the passage of time. "I fear you must excuse me, my lady. I've an appointment I cannot miss."
Hero drew on her mittens with quick, jerky movements. "Yes, of course. Thank you for your information." He sketched another of his elegant bows.
"Please do not hesitate to let me know if I can be of further assistance."
"Oh, don't worry. I shall," she said with a smile. It was when he was escorting her to the door that Van der Pals said,
"Have you by chance spoken to Valentino Vescovi?"
She paused to glance over at him. "The musician? No. Why?"
"He teaches the harp to Princess Charlotte, you know."
"No, I didn't know."
"Is there a particular reason you think I should speak with him?"
Van der Pals scratched one cheek as if in some embarrassment.
"Actually, yes. You see, he and Jane had quite an angry confrontation just this past Monday."
"How do you know this?"
"Because they were unwise enough to engage in an undignified shouting match beside the canal in St. James's Park. Vescovi is an ice-gliding enthusiast, and he's been going there every afternoon to take advantage of our current freezing conditions."
When Hero remained silent, he added,
"A number of others were present, and the argument was quite heated. I doubt I was the only one who saw them."
"And what was the nature of their quarrel?"
"I fear I couldn't hear well enough to understand what was being said, although..."
He broke off. "Yes?"
"I did hear Vescovi tell her she needed to be careful."
"About what?"
"That I didn't hear. Only, you need to be careful."
"Perhaps Vescovi was warning her about you," suggested Hero, and had the satisfaction of seeing Van der Pals's self-satisfied, confident smile slip. Chapter 10. The Prince Regent's powerful cousin, Charles, Lord Jarvis, was smiling faintly as the men carrying his sedan chair staggered through the deep drifts that continued to render even such vital streets as Whitehall, Cockspur, and Pall Mall impassable to anything except foot traffic. The snow was undoubtedly a nuisance, but Jarvis, who'd had a busy morning and was heading back to Carlton House after a meeting at Downing Street, was concerned with far weightier matters, namely the looming inevitable defeat of Napoleon and the enormous task of restructuring Europe.
Things were going well in that quarter, quite well indeed.
Carlton House had been home to the Prince of Wales for more than 3 decades, and His Highness had spent every one of those years altering, expanding, and refurbishing it into something he considered more befitting to the heir to the throne of the greatest kingdom on earth. As his dear, trusted cousin, Jarvis generally encouraged him, despite the onerous cost. The Prince's preoccupation with art, architecture, fashion, and jewels allowed more serious and mentally stable men to go about the business of actually running the kingdom, They were approaching the palace now, and the chairmen were labouring hard, but Jarvis was well over 6 feet tall and increasingly fleshy as he headed toward his 60th year. When they turned in through the ornate classical screen that separated the forecourt of Carlton House from Pall Mall, he noticed with revulsion a ragged, skeletal woman clutching what looked like a dead child in her arms as she leaned against the base of the row of columns. He made a mental note to have her removed. Some minutes later, having finished giving his instructions to the guards, he was walking toward the palace's entrance when he became aware of the tall, leanly built figure of his daughter's husband, Viscount Devlin, crossing the forecourt. Jarvis ignored him.
"I was hoping I'd find you here," said Devlin pleasantly.
Jarvis kept walking.
"I wish I could say I'm delighted not to have disappointed you, but I fear that would be beyond even my considerable powers of dissemblance."
The Viscount gave a huff of laughter and fell into step beside him. "I think you underestimate yourself." Jarvis grunted.
"What do you want?"
"You mean besides Jane Ambrose's body?"
"You're sadly behind the times, I fear. The inquest was held this morning."
"Already?"
"Without the testimony of those who found her." "And the lady's corpse delivered to her husband in Soho Square."
"Along with a warning not to allow it to fall into my hands again, I assume."
"Edward Ambrose is no fool."
The footman flanking the palace's magnificent classical portal jumped to open the doors wide and bowed as Jarvis swept past them. Devlin said, "Why are you so determined to prevent any real investigation into what happened to her?" Jarvis crossed the hall toward the imposing main staircase, his boot heels clicking on the polished marble floor.
"You think her death should concern me, do you?"
"You consider the murder of a young woman on the streets of London of no importance?"
"She was not murdered. But even if she were, when her death is set beside affairs of state, it is beyond insignificant."
"That still doesn't explain why you're blocking any investigation."
Jarvis drew up at the foot of the stairs.
"Really, Devlin, are you truly such a fool, or are you simply determined to play one? The last thing the Regent needs at the moment is to have Princess Charlotte's name bandied about in conjunction with that of a woman unwise enough to get mixed up in something as tawdry as murder."
"At the moment? And why is this moment any different from all the others?"
Jarvis pressed his lips together and began to mount the sweeping marble steps. Devlin kept pace with him.
"I had an interesting conversation this morning with Nathan Rothschild. He asked if I'd spoken to you."
"Why is that, I wonder?"
"Stay away from Rothschild."
"Oh? Why?"
Jarvis paused and swung to face him. He kept his voice low, his words coming out clipped and deadly.
"You think because you are married to my daughter you are safe? You're not."
Devlin didn't even blink.
"I never made the mistake of imagining I was, but it does raise the question. Why are you so anxious to keep me away from Rothschild?"
Jarvis continued up the stairs.
"Curiosity is a dangerous weakness. You should strive to overcome it."
"This isn't about curiosity.
It's about justice for a vital, talented young woman left in a snowy street with her head bashed in."
"Justice."
Jarvis rolled the word with distaste off his tongue. "This maudlin obsession of yours with vague and essentially useless philosophical constructs is beyond tiresome.
Justice comes from God."
"So do you believe that what is morally good is commanded by God because it is morally good? Or is it morally good because God commands it? Because if the latter, then all justice is arbitrary. But if the former, then morality exists on a higher plane than God."
"Don't try to argue Plato with me. That's a false dilemma, and you know it."
"Is it?"
"Apart from which, you're simply wrong. Jane Ambrose's death has nothing to do with Rothschild."
"So certain.
It has nothing to do with Rothschild and nothing to do with Princess Charlotte.
Then why are you afraid of what an investigation might discover?
These are delicate and dangerous times. You would cause more harm than you know.
Oh? So explain it to me.
Jarvis made a rude noise deep in his throat.
You've been warned.
Then he walked into his chambers and shut the door in his son-in-law's face. Chapter 11. Frozen, solid and milky white under a cloudy sky, the canal in St. James's Park was crowded with skaters of all ages. Hero bought a cup of hot cider from one of the booths pitched near the lake's snow-encrusted banks and strolled along the edge of the ice, her gaze moving over the laughing, shouting mass of skaters. A few were well-dressed young bucks, mainly Scottish by the sounds of it, who belonged to skating clubs and obviously took their sports seriously. But most were considerably less practiced, either creeping cautiously along with shiny new blades strapped to their boots, or else striking out in ungainly rushes that inevitably ended in spectacular crashes. It didn't take her long to spot the Italian harpist, Valentino Vescovi. A lanky, craggy-faced man dressed in black with a red scarf tied around his neck, he was in a class by himself, gliding effortlessly across the ice as he executed an intricate pattern of graceful figures reminiscent of a courtly dance. She stood for a time watching him, but after throwing one or two glances in her direction, he finally skated straight toward her, stopping with a flourish just offshore by leaning back on his heels with the acorn-tipped fronts of his skates pointing into the air. He was a man somewhere in his 30s or 40s, with dark hair and an expressive mobile face. He'd come to London perhaps a dozen years before via Amsterdam, which was presumably where he'd learned ice gliding.
"Bene,"
he said, his breath coming fast from the recent exercise.
"I'd like to think you're focused on me because you admire my skating. But that's not it, is it? You're here because of Jane Ambrose, yes?"
Hero choked on her cider. "How did you know?" His dark eyes gleamed with what might have been amusement.
"You were at Warwick House this morning, Lady Devlin, and the walls there have ears."
"Evidently."
He said, "What I don't understand is why you wish to speak with me."
"I'm told you had an argument with Jane Ambrose last Monday. A very public argument. Here, by the canal."
"Ah."
He climbed carefully off the ice to perch on a nearby bench and set to work unstrapping the skates from his boots.
"I did, yes. It was so public, in fact, that I see no point in attempting to deny it."
"Your honesty is refreshing." He glanced up, the first skate loose in his hand, and bobbed a self-deprecating little bow.
"Grazie. Care to tell me the subject of your disagreement?"
He bent over his task again.
"A certain personage told Mrs. Ambrose something about me, something unflattering. And no, I have no intention of spreading the information any further by telling you what it was."
"Was it true?"
"As it happens, yes, it was true. But I managed to convince her it wasn't as serious as it sounded."
"And which personage told this unflattering truth about you?"
He lifted one shoulder in a very Italian shrug as he tugged at the leather straps holding the second skate to his boot.
"I do not recall."
"I don't believe you." At that, he laughed out loud.
"No? Well, believe this. If I were ever to decide to kill someone, it would be the figlio di puttana who was spreading such tales of me."
He looked up, his face now utterly serious.
"Not Jane Ambrose."
An older man and a little girl sailed past on the ice. The man skating, the grinning child simply holding on to the tails of his coat and gliding along in his wake. Hero said, "What do you know about the friendship between Jane and the Dutch courtier Peter van der Pauls?" The harpist's expressive face twitched into a frown as he pursed his lips.
I don't think I'd go so far as to call it a friendship.
What would you call it?
He gave another shrug that could have meant anything and nothing.
Vanderpaal's played the gallant, and I suppose she enjoyed having a handsome, well-connected young man seem to find her interesting and attractive.
That's all. He threaded the straps of his skates together and fastened the buckles.
That's all. And then he began to make her uncomfortable.
How? Vescovi pushed to his feet.
Presumably because he began expecting favours she was unwilling to grant him.
Hero studied the harpist's bony, wide-featured face. Were they lovers?
Goodness gracious, no.
So certain?
Yes.
Did she have a lover, do you think? He looped the skates over one shoulder.
It's hardly the sort of thing we discussed.
No?
Yet you know Vanderpaal's wasn't her lover and that he made her uncomfortable.
Oh, yes. Hero handed her cup to the booth's boy and turned with Vescovi to walk up the packed icy footpath that ran along the canal. Hero said, I was told Jane became jealous when Vanderpaal's transferred his attention to another woman.
Who told you that?
It's not true.
Hardly.
So was Vanderpaal's flattering Jane in an attempt to convince her to spy on Princess Charlotte for him. Vescovi's brows twitched together, but he kept staring straight ahead and remained silent.
That is it, isn't it?
Said Hero. The Italian let out his breath in a long, pained sigh.
Princess Charlotte might be young and tucked away in her own crumbling, cramped establishment, separate from the rest of the royal family's various palaces and castles. Her household is still part of the royal court.
He grimaced.
And show me a court that isn't alive with intrigue and spying.
Is that why you warned Jane to be careful?
That was part of it, yes.
Only a part. Hero studied the Italian's bony, troubled profile. Who do you think killed her?
I wish I knew. Believe me.
Why should I believe you?
Why?
He drew up and swung to face her, his dark eyes intense and shadowed.
Because I teach Princess Charlotte to play a musical instrument. Just as Jane Ambrose taught the princess to play an instrument, and now Jane is dead.
His face went oddly bleak, as if he were maintaining his composure with effort.
You think I'm not afraid?
You think she might have been killed by someone you both knew? Someone who might also be a threat to you?
I see it as a possibility, yes.
You do not. So exactly whom do you have in mind?
No one in particular.
No one? If you're afraid, why not be more honest with me?
I have told you nothing that isn't true.
Perhaps. Yet I suspect there is much that you could tell me, but have not. He stared off across the white undulating expanses of the park, its bushes and hollows now reduced to anonymous snow-covered mounds and dips.
The truth is frequently more dangerous than a lie.
Then tell me who you are afraid of, Hero said quietly.
Ah.
His lips twitched into a self-deprecating, unexpected smile.
But that would be the most dangerous of all.
Chapter 12. The ancient cobbled lane that separated young Princess Charlotte's dilapidated residence from the gardens of her father's grand palace was known as Stonecutter's Alley. On leaving Carlton House, Sebastian had to pass through the classical colonnade that guarded the palace's forecourt from the street, turn right, and walk past four tall houses before turning right again into the narrow lane. At one time, the Prince of Wales had sought to seize the lane in order to expand his palace. But Stonecutter's Alley provided the only public approach to St. James's Park from Pall Mall, and so great was the popular outcry that he was forced to give up the scheme. When he reached the surprisingly dilapidated brick wall that sheltered Warwick House's Renaissance courtyard from the lane, Sebastian paused, his eyes narrowed against the snow. The fresh white blanket gave the scene a simple, peaceful air, but he knew that was deceptive. The young princess was separated physically and in almost every other way from her father, the regent, yet her position as second in line to the throne made access to her both rare and coveted. And corridors of power were also dangerous. He tipped back his head, his gaze scanning the brick house's upper floors, and saw a curtain move at one window. It shifted for only an instant, and then hung still. But he knew someone had been watching him. The sound of a house's front door opening and closing carried clearly in the snowy hush. Sebastian heard the crunch of footsteps crossing the snow-filled yard toward him. The solid wooden gate's heavy iron latch twisted with a creak, and the gate jerked inward to reveal an older man in an exquisitely tailored cassock and an old-fashioned periwig. He looked to be in his late 60s, with swooping heavy brows that drew together in a fierce frown.
"What precisely do you think you are doing?" demanded the prelate, his long, prominent nose twitching. "I don't know who you are or why you are here, young man, but you best move on before I—"
"The name is Devlin," said Sebastian, calmly handing the man his card. The prelate broke off, his thin-lipped little mouth going slack as he took the card.
"Ah, my lord."
Mouth tightening, he gave a curt, begrudging bow.
"I beg your pardon. I did not recognize you."
He sniffed.
"Allow me to introduce myself. I'm the Bishop of Salisbury, preceptor to Her Royal Highness the Princess Charlotte."
"Bishop," said Sebastian with a polite bow. He had heard of the Right Reverend Dr. John Fisher, Bishop of Salisbury. With a reputation as a humorless, vain, self-important clergyman, Salisbury had coordinated the princess's education for nearly 10 years. He had an affected manner of speaking and a strange way of pronouncing the word bishop, so that it came out sounding like bishop. Sebastian had heard that Charlotte, who heartily detested the humorless man and possessed a gift for mimicry, had long ago nicknamed him the Great Up. The Great Up sniffed again.
"I noticed someone loitering in the lane and thought it best to move them along."
"Oh?
Can't be too careful, what?" said the bishop. "Not when one considers what happened to Mrs. Ambrose."
"So you don't believe she simply slipped on the ice?" said Sebastian.
"Oh, no, 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 of course I believe it."
The Great Up gave an incredulous scoff that told Sebastian the bishop knew only too well why Sebastian was here.
"To suggest otherwise would be ridiculous."
"Would it?"
"But of course."
"Did you see her yesterday?"
"I did, yes. We encountered each other in the entrance hall just as she was leaving."
"What time was this?"
"Must have been shortly after noon, I suppose."
"You spoke to her?"
"Briefly. We exchanged a few pleasantries, nothing more."
"Do you know where she planned to go after leaving Warwick House?"
"Sorry, no, I couldn't say."
The bishop gave an exaggerated sigh.
"Shocking to think that only a few hours later she was dead.
A timely reminder to us all to be prepared to meet our Maker at any moment." Sebastian was beginning to understand why the young princess found the prelate so annoying.
"Do you know if she had any enemies?"
"Enemies?"
The Great Up drew back his head in an exaggerated gesture of disbelief, nicely combined with obvious disapproval.
"Of course not."
"No?
She was a pianist."
"Pianists don't have enemies." The bishop's full cheeks darkened.
"Jane Ambrose slipped in the snow, hit her head and died. To suggest anything more nefarious is at work here is not only frivolous, but is also irresponsible. And given the woman's relationship to the princess, dangerously nearly to the point of sedition."
"Sedition? Seriously?" The Great Up glared at Sebastian in righteous silence. Sebastian touched his hat.
"Thank you, Bishop. You've been most helpful."
The prelate responded with a stiff bow, took a step back, and closed the old heavy gate with a reverberating crash. Sebastian stood still for a moment, the snow falling gently around him. He was about to turn away when he became aware of an elegant young woman in a fur-trimmed pelisse and a jaunty Swedish hat emerging from the public footpath that wound up from St. James's Park. She was an extraordinarily tall woman, nearly as tall as he, with strong, handsome features, and the aquiline nose of her father, Lord Jarvis. "Good heavens," said Hero, blinking against the falling snow as she came up to him. "What are you doing here?"
"I was about to ask you the same question."
"I've been watching an Italian harpist ice skate."
"And that's an explanation?"
She linked her mittened hand through his proffered arm and smiled. "It is." They turned their steps toward Brook Street while she told him what she had learned from her friend Miss Kinsworth and her subsequent conversations with the Dutch courtier and the harpist Valentino Vescovi.
"So which of the two men do you think is telling the truth?"
Sebastian asked, his gaze on her profile. "Van der Pals or Vescovi?" She shook her head. "I'm not convinced either of them is. Although if I had to put money on one or the other, I'd pick the Italian harpist over the decorative Dutch courtier any day."
"Because what he told you agrees better with what you heard from your friend, Mrs. Kinsworth?"
"Partially. But I suspect it also has something to do with my profound aversion to handsome young men who believe themselves so charming that no female can resist them."
"Ah."
Hero looked troubled. "Could Van der Pals have killed Jane simply because she'd exposed his attempts to convince her to spy on Princess Charlotte? He did say she'd be sorry if she'd betrayed him."
"I wouldn't put it past him. Except, how did he know Jane told someone? Unless, of course, your Miss Kinsworth wasn't actually as silent as she claims."
Hero gazed off across the snow-filled intersection of Piccadilly and Bond Street, her features troubled.
"What?"
he asked. "I just wish I were more convinced that Ella Kinsworth was being completely honest with me. Don't misunderstand me. I believe her to be a good, honourable woman. But when you serve as lady companion to a princess, you can't always be as truthful as you'd like." The snow was coming down harder now, filling their world with a whirl of white.
"I can't believe the regent is seriously considering marrying his daughter to slender Billy," said Sebastian, squinting up at the heavy sky.
She glanced over at him. "Orange was with Wellington in the peninsula when you were there, was he not?"
"He was."
"So you knew him?"
"I did."
"And Van der Pels as well?"
Sebastian nodded. "The two were inseparable."
"Meaning?" His gaze met hers.
"Meaning a great deal. But I'm afraid it's not something one can discuss in the middle of Bond Street, even if most of the shops are shuttered because of the snow."
"Oh, dear. And does it have anything to do with why you were at Carlton House seeing my father?"
"Ah, you figured that out, did you?"
He told her then about his meeting with Jane's bereaved husband and the pianist's puzzling dismissal by Nathan Rothschild. He did not tell her that Jarvis had essentially threatened to have him killed. "For a simple musician," said Hero, as they turned up a snow-filled, strangely silent Brook Street toward home, "Jane Ambrose lived an unexpectedly dangerous life."
"When you deal with people like the Rothschilds and the royal family," said Sebastian, "life is never simple."
It was late in the afternoon by the time Sebastian met with his friend Paul Gibson at the surgeon's favourite tavern near the tower.
"Sorry I wasn't there to help you with the inquest last night," said Gibson, the pupils of his Irish green eyes noticeably small despite the dimness of the ancient Tudor tavern. "With both Alexei and me working, we might have found something before the palace came to seize the body."
"I doubt there was much more to find," said Sebastian, taking a deep drink of his ale.
So, have you discovered how that poor woman came to be lying in the middle of a snow-filled lane?
No.
Sebastian leaned back in his seat, aware of a growing sense of frustration of having spent the entire day grasping